Leviticus 15. We're looking at a number of different things. We looked in chapter 13 of the various examinations of leprosy upon the people and what to do with them in chapter 14. Laws concerning childbirth in chapter 12. And we've come to chapter 15. And each of these different chapters, really, there's something that we've got to picture beyond the specific rules and regulations in regard to the actual problems that they had. Because there is something going on here in this instruction that's training them to discern between the clean and the unclean, to discern that the leprosy, which is a type of sin, everything that comes out of a person, everything that a person can produce, and especially in this chapter 15, where it's references to discharges of a particular person. And of course, we could look at this from a health standpoint, and it makes total sense. But I think there's more than that. I think the Lord is interested in more than just them being physically healthy, that He goes to such great lengths to describe these things. That in reality, there's a spiritual picture here too. And as we look at this, I think of all these different discharges that would put a person in being separated and being outside the camp or being unclean for a period of time or having to go through a ceremony for a purity to be declared pure after the discharge was complete, gives to me a picture of really anything that comes out from us is sin. When the woman would give birth, you know, the blood that would come and the child coming into the world pictured, you know, the 7 days of impurity, then 33 days of being set apart in impurity, 40 days total, kind of a signal of judgment for bringing really a sinner into the world. There's the idea there. The Lord is constantly trying to get His people to be conscious of, I believe, of seeing everything that comes from us. Well, Romans 7:18 says, I know that in me, that is my flesh, Paul declares, dwells no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I don't find. And I think that's a good picture. If we could understand that which comes from within us is sin, and it will always be. Jesus said, out of the heart come foolish thoughts and evil lusts and all those things. That's in our flesh. The Lord has to produce in us a whole new life. So let's jump into that with that type of, or this chapter with that type of sensitivity, and we'll see what comes up. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean. And this shall be his uncleanness in regard to his discharge. Whether his body runs with his discharge or his body is stopped up by his discharge, it's uncleanness or his uncleanness. Every bed. And now, this is the fascinating thing. I mean, that's fine for him. But now notice the impact of this. Some people think that this was a judicial punishment on some. In 2 Samuel, David kind of gives a kind of a curse in his dying words regarding Joab because of the trouble that Joab, his advisor and his general, gave him. He said, it rests on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and let there not fail from the house of Joab one that has an issue or a leper or one that leans on a staff or falls on a sword. So he's kind of pronouncing judgment on Joab's family. And one of the judgments is one of those guys will have an issue, you know, which would have put them in a place of being unclean. Well, notice what happens. Verse 4, every bed is unclean on which he who has the discharge lies, and everything on which he sits shall be unclean. And whoever touches his bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Who sits on anything in which he who has the discharge sat, shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And he who touches the body of him who has the discharge shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. If he who has the discharge spits on him who is clean, then he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. So you don't want to go around spitting on each other. Any saddle on which, that kind of reminds me of a story Dr. Dobson shared that was kind of funny. He was driving, you know, in the car, and his little children were with him, and they passed a movie theater that was, you know, advertising an X-rated movie. And his daughter, who was just coming into her teen years, said, Dad, there's some really dirty things that go on in there, aren't there?
And his father said, yes, there are some really dirty things that are going on. And his little son was only about 4 years old, sitting in the back and just was listening, didn't say anything. That night as he was putting him to bed, he said, Dad, I want to pray. And so he was praying, Lord, and I just pray that you help all those people in that dirty movie, those people that are spitting on each other. And that's the dirtiest thing he could think of. It's all he could picture in his mind. It's all those people that are spitting on each other in that movie theater. So from the mouth of a child. So any saddle on which he who has the discharge rides shall be unclean. Whoever touches anything that that was under him shall be unclean until evening. He who carries any of those things shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And whomever he who has the discharge touches and has not rinsed his hands in water, he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. You get the redundancy of this. Wash, be unclean until evening. The vessel of earth that he who has the discharge touches shall be broken, and every vessel of wood shall be rinsed in water. And when he who has a discharge is cleansed of his discharge, then he shall count for himself 7 days for his cleansing, wash his clothes and bathe in water, in running water, and then he shall be clean. The idea here too, when you consider any type of a discharge, to the Jew it was all the more hateful, because in a discharge that would have come from a man's body, especially in the area of, you know, having some type of discharge in his genital region, the Jews would have considered that all the more hateful, because that would have been the sign of circumcision, or where circumcision would have been taking place, and the seal that they had with God in cutting the foreskin of their flesh away. That would have been very odious to them to have any discharge there, so it would even the more had that type of picture. But how this person is now cleansed, notice verse 14. On the eighth day he shall take for himself two turtle doves or two young pigeons and come before the Lord to the door of the tabernacle of meeting and give them to the priest, and the priest shall offer them, the one as a sin offering, the other as a burnt offering. So the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord because of his discharge. Now, I find that fascinating. A full atonement is made for this type of thing using the turtle doves, which would have been emblems of purity, required as much for any secret sin as well as flagrant sins. See, this would be something that would, I think, represent secretly coming from a person. No one's really going to know about it but you, if you have a discharge. And where other types of things like leprosy would be an obvious thing, this would be a secret thing. And there's an interesting comparison morally there, that they're responsible even for those things secretly that are happening to them, and the same type of atonement is made for secret sins. Now, if any man has an emission of semen, then he shall wash his body in water and be unclean till evening. And any garment and any leather on which there is semen, it shall be washed with water and be unclean till evening. And when a woman lies with a man and there is an emission of semen, which naturally there would be, if any relations would be a man and his wife, they'll bathe in water and be unclean till evening. So the whole process, really, I think people have gotten this picture in their mind as a result of some of these passages in the Puritan age, that sex was dirty, that it was not good, that God did not look upon it as something that was good. What I see as the picture, though, is anything that has to do with reproduction. God is ingraining in the minds of his people that we're sinners, and that anything to do with producing sinners is unclean. Anything along those lines is unclean. Not that having relationships with a husband and wife is evil. It's not. It's something that God gave to be enjoyed. In fact, the Bible describes how husbands and wives should minister to each other the duty the Lord has given them to perform with each other. The marriage bed is undefiled, the scripture says. But if a woman has a discharge, and though a discharge from her body is blood, she shall be set apart 7 days. Whoever touches her shall be unclean till evening. And everything that she lies on during her impurity shall be unclean. And also everything she sits on shall be unclean. Again, the semen from the men and the menstrual discharge from the woman. The same principle here, I think, is being presented, that you're speaking of reproduction. Whoever touches her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean till evening. And whoever touches anything that she has sat on shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean till evening. If anything on her bed or anything on which she sits, when he touches it, it shall be unclean till evening. And if any man lies with her at all so that her impurity is on him, he shall be unclean 7 days. And every bed on which he lies shall be unclean. And if a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, other than at the time of her customary impurity, or if it runs beyond her usual time of impurity, All the days of her unclean discharge shall be as the days of her customary impurity. She'll be unclean. And every bed in which she lies all the days of her discharge shall be to her as the bed of her impurity, and whatever she sits on shall be unclean as the uncleanness of her impurity. Now, this is an amazing thing. You know, there was a woman in Mark chapter 5 that had a flow of blood for 12 years. Now, if you put yourself in her shoes, can you imagine? From the judicial standpoint, she would have been unclean, not having the ability to have any type of social interaction with anyone else in that period of time, or keeping a distance, not careful what she touches, or whom she touches, or what she sits on, so that someone else would not be unclean. Can you imagine the type of life that would have made her have sought the physicians? Mark says she suffered many things because of many things of many physicians. I can imagine them experimenting with her, trying different things to help her, but she got no help. And then a very interesting thing is, she goes and she has it in her mind that if she just touches the hem of Jesus' garment, she'll be made whole. Now, to reach out and touch him would have been against the law. But the picture there for Jesus, I think, is fascinating. You see, in a lot of ways, what we've got to see in this is the term in Zechariah that I spoke about this morning in Zechariah 13:1. In that day, there will be a fountain open to the house of David, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for sin and uncleanness. The prophet's speaking about the time Messiah would come. And in a way, Jesus acts. Remember when something was unclean or a dead carcass would touch anything, it would be unclean. The only thing it wouldn't make unclean would be a cistern of water, a large body of water, because the water itself would be used for cleansing. Here is a picture of Jesus, really a fountain. Nothing could really defile him by touching him. In fact, he would have the opposite effect. There was healing in his life, in his power, and he recognized power went out from him to heal this woman when she touched him. And he encouraged her and said, you know, it has been done according to your faith. She believed. She recognized he was the Messiah. She believed in him being a fountain that she would not defile by touching, but she would receive healing. And I think there's a beautiful picture there. But there's an application in this chapter. As you go on to see every, you know, bed in which she lies all the days of her discharge shall be the bed of her impurity. Whatever she sits on shall be unclean as the uncleanness of her impurity. Whoever touches those things shall be unclean. He shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, and be unclean till evening. But if she's cleansed of her discharge, she'll count for herself 7 days. And the same type of prescription would be there with the turtle doves. And verse 31, this is the point. Thus you shall separate the children of Israel from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness when they defile my tabernacle that is among them. This is the law for one who has a discharge, and for him who emits semen is unclean thereby, and for her who is indisposed because of her customary impurity, and for one who has a discharge, either man or woman, for him who lies with her who is unclean. Now, in application, what I see here is that there are many things, a great many things in this world to avoid. This is what the children of Israel are learning from the point of animals, unclean, clean, unclean, clean, training them in the wilderness. You know, then anything that emits from them is unclean. Leprosy, that which could come upon them, unclean. So many things separate them, and they're being taught there are many things to avoid, that you cannot just take your ease, you have to be on guard. I think the application for us is, you have to be careful the places you go and the people you're around. The Bible says bad company corrupts good morals. The people you choose to hang around with are going to affect you. You become like the people you hang out with. You know, make sure of that. You've got to know that. It's been said, show me a person's friends and I'll show you the person. Another rural type of piece of advice is that if you look at it this way, it's easier to pull a person off a chair than to pull others up on top of the chair. When you're in company that, you know, is wrong and is falling away from God and is blaspheming God, what's going to happen eventually to you? It's going to be a lot harder for you to be in that midst and pull them up than it is for them to pull you down. Realize that. I think this picture and this chapter gives us that understanding. God desires truth in the inner person. Beware of any little hidden thing that is there within you, any hidden grudge or bitterness or hidden desire that you have. Be careful that you don't nurse it. Anything that's wrong. Any proud thought. Any selfish wish. Any sexual thoughts. We succumb to them when we parley with them. When we give them an opportunity. You know, the Bible says, make no opportunity for the flesh. You've got to see this. You've got to make sure that there's many of opportunities out there that your flesh could fall. You should be conscious of that and walk in such a way that you're wise. You don't go in places that you know you're going to stumble. You're wise in keeping in a place where you're going to be safe, knowing, putting whatever hedge is necessary about your life. In the same way, a Jewish person in this type of setting would have been very cautious in what he sat on, what he touched, and it would have been that consciousness of the unclean clean that eventually would carry on to his moral instruction. And the same type of instruction, really, as Christians, we need to have. Now, that doesn't mean we go out of the world. See, they were in the world, but they were to act wisely, and we have to be wise in this world. So there is that picture here that I see. Now, in the next chapter, we looked at the main points of the Day of Atonement in chapter 16 this morning. I want to run through it. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron when they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron, your brother, not to come at simply any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die. For I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. So an indication that Aaron's sons maybe had progressed a little bit too far, offering up strange fire. Whether they were under the influence of alcohol, it's possible according to the context in that chapter. But for whatever reason, the Lord wants to reiterate, tell Aaron he can't just come any old time. And there's a picture here for once a year to make atonement. Thus Aaron shall come into the holy place with the blood of a young bull as a sin offering and as a ram as a burnt offering and put on the holy linen tunic and the linen trousers on his body and be girded with a linen sash and with a linen turban he shall be attired. So he's taking upon the garments of a man, linen, putting aside his priestly garments. And these are holy garments, therefore he shall wash his body in water and put them on. And he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of goats as a sin offering and one ram as a burnt offering. So he takes a bull and a ram for him and for a burnt offering, and then he takes the goats for the sin offering for the people. Then Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement, covering, kofar, for the people, for himself and for his house, rather. And he shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat. And Aaron shall bring the goat on which the Lord's lot fell and offer it as a sin offering. And the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it and let it go as the scapegoat into the wilderness. Again, that picture of the scapegoat, this little goat taking the blame for the sins of the people. And that word scapegoat really is probably not even the best translation. Again, the translators are in the King James Version actually just don't even translate it. They just bring out Azazel, you know. And in fact, there's a picture there that some have even had that this was actually given over to the demonic realm by sending it into the wilderness. One goat is for the Lord and one goat is for the demonic realm. But that opens up a whole can of worms with some pagan practices, so I have a difficult time with that translation. I think it's meant, again, as we looked at, to head off into the wilderness as a representation. The sin will be remembered no more. And Aaron shall bring the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house, and shall kill the bull as the sin offering, which is for himself. Then he'll take a censer full of burning coals of fire from the altar before the Lord with his hands full of sweet incense beaten fine and bring it inside the veil. So he first goes in the veil with this incense burning. And picture, it's all smoky, you know, and it's meant to represent the prayers that he goes in trembling, not with boldness, trembling with prayers and supplications. And he does this. And he puts the incense and the fire before the Lord, and the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the testimony, lest he die. So this idea of surrounding himself with prayer. And he shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat on the east side, and before the mercy seat he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger seven times. So the front there, because he'd be going into the east, sprinkle it right in the front and then on the ground before it. Then he'll kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people. Bring its blood inside the veil. And do that with that blood as he did with the blood of the bull and sprinkle it on the mercy seat before the mercy seat. And he shall make atonement So he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgressions, for all their sins. So he shall do for the tabernacle of meeting which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanness. There shall be no man in the tabernacle of meeting when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place, and when he comes out, or until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself, for his household, for all the congregation of Israel. So the high priest going in once a year, representing the entire nation, in the same way Jesus really is our high priest, and he once for all. The high priest, beset with sins themselves, had to make offerings for themselves and had to do it yearly. Did not stick. But it's a type of Jesus coming once and for all and offering himself up as a perfect sacrifice. Then he'll go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it, and take some of the blood of the bull, some of the blood of the goat, and put it on the horns of the altar all around, and he'll sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger seven times. Picture of seven is usually that of completeness. Cleanse it, sanctify it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. And when he has made an end of atoning for the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting, and the altar, he'll bring the live goat. And Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by a hand of a suitable man. Beautiful picture there of the Lord Jesus Christ, one who is worthy. Who is worthy, you know, is the question in Revelation, to open the scroll. You know, who is worthy? And there is none. And John begins to cry, there is none found in all of the world that is worthy to open the scroll in Revelation 5. And then you see the picture of the Lord, the Lamb, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, pressing forward, and he is worthy to open the scroll, a suitable man. And the goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities, go to an inhabited, uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat into the wilderness. And Aaron shall come and take into the tabernacle of meeting and take off the linen garments by which he put on when he went into the holy place and leave them there. And he'll wash his body with water. So again, this picture of just getting all the defilement off. He'll wash his body in a holy place, put on his garments, come out and offer burnt offering and the burnt offering of his people and make atonement for himself and for the people. And the fat of the sin offering he shall burn on the altar, and he who released the goat as the scapegoat shall wash his clothes and bathe in water. And afterward he may come into the camp. And the bull for the sin offering and the goat for the sin offering, whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place, shall be carried outside the camp. And they shall burn in the fire their skins, their flesh, and their offal. Then he who burns them shall wash his clothes and bathe with water. So this incredible procedure of constantly sacrifice, bathing, trying to, you know, get every last trace of any sin or remnant of sin off of themselves. Verse 29 says, "This shall be a statute forever for you. In the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, you shall afflict your souls," which is the term for fast and humble themselves, "and do no work at all, whether a native of your own country or a stranger who sojourns among you. For on the day the priest shall make atonement for you to cleanse you, that you may be clean from all your sins before the Lord. It is a Sabbath of solemn rest for you, Shabbat Shabbaton, a Sabbath of Sabbaths. You shall afflict your souls. It is a statute forever. And the priest who is anointed and consecrated to minister as priest in his father's place shall make atonement and put on the linen clothes and holy garments. And then he'll make atonement for the holy sanctuary, atonement for the tabernacle of meeting, for the altar, make atonement for the priests, for all the people of the congregation. And this shall be an everlasting statute for you, to make atonement for the children of Israel for all their sins once a year. And he did as the Lord commanded Moses." So this picture of the Day of Atonement, a very important day in the life of the Jewish people. Now, it's amazing that of all the feasts, you don't see this throughout the history of the children of Israel practiced. Now, it might be something that's just unspoken. It's something they practice today. But during, you know, their history, going through the wilderness, and you know that they're, and even in the time of the kings, they celebrate the Passover, they celebrate the other feasts, but this particular thing doesn't seem to be mentioned very frequently. So whether or not they left it off, or whether it's just an unspoken understanding that this was certainly to be done, has left us just to guess about that. In chapter 17, we have some restrictions or regulations in regard to what they would eat and how they would prepare it. Now, up to this point, the only meat that they would eat would be meat that would be offered as a sacrifice, and the Lord would have his part, the fat, and then they would get their part. The problem is, you know, that's quite a regulation. It tells you that there were a lot of sacrifices going on, but it also tells you that meat was not as eaten as often as they would eat many of the other things. In fact, through the wilderness, you know that they had mostly manna. They spared their crops or their cattle and their rams, and basically would only use them for sacrifices. And then they would get their portion during the feasts and during the sacrifices. But there were certain abuses, and Moses foresees that. In chapter 17, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons and to all the children of Israel, and say to them, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded, saying, whatever man of the house of Israel kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or who kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting." In other words, he's killing something and he's not offering it as a sacrifice. To offer it as an offering to the Lord before the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guilt shall be imputed to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people. In other words, unauthorized sacrifice. To the end that the children of Israel may bring their sacrifices which they offer in the open field, that they may bring them to the Lord at the door. Instead of making them in the open field, bring them to the door of the tabernacle of meeting to the priest and offer them as peace offerings to the Lord. In other words, the peace offering would be that which the Lord would get the fat, and the blood would be spilled, and you would get your part. And the priest shall sprinkle the blood on the altar of the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and burn the fat for a sweet aroma to the Lord. And there shall no more offer their sacrifices, or they shall no more offer their sacrifices to demons. Literally, the word is goat gods, after whom they have played the harlot. This shall be a statute forever for them throughout their generations. It seems that the pagans would do things with the blood in their worship of their gods. They would oftentimes pour out this blood into a hole, and there'd be some type of a ritual. In the Egyptian god Mendes, which was the same as the Greek god Pan, it had a great influence on the children of Israel. In fact, even when you go to Israel today and you go up into Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus spent a lot of time with his disciples, today it carries the name Banyas Falls. That comes from the Greek term Panyas, which meant, you know, a garden of the gods, or the god, actually the same god, the Egyptian god Mendes, the Greek god Pan, a god that was believed to be half man and half faun, kind of what we would say is a satyr. And it's a fascinating thing to consider how far they got infected by this mentality. But even today you see remnants of it in Israel. In fact, in some of the archaeological digs, they find certain offerings to these various gods built in the walls of the homes in the Canaanite places that they find, and also in some of the children of Israel's homes. So they were infected by this, and so the Lord warned them not to offer their sacrifices to this goat god, Mendes, which was something they would have picked up in Egypt. "And say to them, whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among you who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting to offer it to the Lord, that man shall be cut off from among his people. And whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among you eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from his people." So strong restriction on blood for the people of Israel. Naturally, this would make sense that Satan would love to have people misuse the blood, because it would throw confusion on the whole sacrifice and the meaning of the blood and the atonement. So naturally, he would have the people misuse this, or he would be tempting them to eat the blood. But notice what the Lord says in verse 11. "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul." This is why this was so important for the children of Israel. Even today, you know, the meat for Jewish people has to be bled just right. It has to be prepared under the oversight of the rabbi so that it can be called kosher. It has to be prepared just so that they don't partake of the blood. If you kill an animal and don't bleed it properly, or if it dies of itself, the blood is in, you know, the veins, and if it's not properly bled, then you eat the blood along with it. That would have been odious to Israel. Now, the reason is this. it was given for atonement. Now, I do not believe this has any application for us today, because the very purpose of the blood, as it being important, meant that that was something for atonement. Once Jesus offered his blood up for atonement, the blood of animals has no longer the spiritual connotation that it had for the children of Israel. Now, some people try to make a statute out of this or make this something that for us to today. It's not something that was... It was in the early church a contention between Gentile and Jew, certainly. They wanted to have fellowship, but it was a difficult thing because if you were brought up Jewish, you know, you'd get around these people who were eating this meat that was sometimes sacrificed to demons and not prepared in a proper way. The blood would have been, you know, in the veins and coagulated there, and it would have been in the meat. And you couldn't eat that meat if you wanted to be kosher. And so it would be difficult because your Gentile friends are eating it and you're eating your separate meal, so they had separate tables, you know, and it was a problem. And, you know, the church in Acts chapter 15, the council got together, and in order to promote better fellowship among them, James had them write to all the Gentile churches, "We ask that you abstain from pollutions of idols, from fornication, from things strangled." And the animals would have been strangled, the blood would have been in them, and from blood, because that was important in their fellowship. They knew, however, at that time, and Paul had a lot to say about this, because he said, hey, it's not by the works of the law that we're saved. It's by faith in Jesus Christ. So any other restriction he had a difficult time with. He would, I think, would have argued with that, but I see this principle given only because it promoted the fellowship between Jew and Gentile. And later, Paul describes how if you know that what you're doing is stumbling somebody else, then you want to not do it because you want to promote fellowship between them. And certainly someone would have been raised up with a real adverse or a real hatred for that type of a thing, or an abhorrence in their life for eating blood. So it would have really hindered fellowship. So, but this, I believe, the blood was important as long as it was used for atonement. That's what he says here in verse 11. "For it is the atonement for your souls. Therefore I said to the children of Israel, no one among you shall eat blood, nor any stranger who sojourns among you eat blood, and whatever man of the children of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among you, who hunts and catches any animal or bird that may be eaten, he shall pour out his blood, its blood, and cover it with dust." So there was a real careful treating of the blood. "For it is the life of all flesh. Its blood sustains life. Therefore I said to you, the children of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all flesh is its blood. Whoever eats of it shall be cut off. And every person who eats what died naturally or what was torn by beasts, whether he is a native of your own country or stranger, he shall both wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Then he shall be clean. But if he does not wash or bathe his body, then he shall bear his guilt." So anything that was dying naturally or torn by beasts would have had the blood in it. So a very strong picture here. Interesting picture that Jesus said, and realize who he's speaking to. Orthodox Jews of his day, in John chapter 6, verse 53, he said, "Verily, verily, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you." Now, can you imagine what they would have heard in hearing that? I mean, I would imagine their ears perked up. What? And of course, at that time, when he began speaking these things, many people started to leave him, and he turned to his disciples and said, "Are you going to go too?" Because his sayings became very hard, very difficult to understand. What is he talking about? You see, the whole point was that there was going to come a time when his blood was going to be for the atonement. That was going to be life for people, not the blood of bulls and goats. Jesus is making a big deal about his blood that would be shed, and he gives that to us in communion. "Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. This is my blood, which is shed for you." Not that we're actually drinking physical blood that gets, you know, magically changed, as some people maintain, but rather that it symbolizes that blood of the atonement when he died for us. So the restrictions in regard to blood are not repeated. In fact, when we go through these laws, it's important to know this. You will find certain things. Do we worry about that today? Are we supposed to follow it? I mean, isn't that the Bible? Shouldn't we obey that? Understand, as you go through the scriptures, you'll find the Lord give different instructions as they progress in maturity. In fact, he tells them no food could they eat here in this particular chapter except was offered as a sacrifice. in Deuteronomy chapter 12. When you get to that portion, you will find he changes that. He allows them then to eat meat as they so choose. Because this particular point, they were training, they were learning the sacrifices in the tabernacle. He didn't want to have any type of pagan confusion, any type of mixed worship in there. He wanted to keep it pure. But when they came into the land of Canaan and they were far away from the temple, they could, you know, they could enjoy a mutton sandwich if they wanted to, and they didn't have to go all the way down to Jerusalem. So you got that picture. And again, as you go through, whatever is not reiterated in the New Testament, understand that if it's not reiterated, it's generally something that was ceremonial for the nation of Israel. It's important to understand that, and you'll get more and more as you go right on through. You'll see how it all comes together. Now, when we come to chapter 18, we come to laws of sexual sins and regulations. This is kind of an amplification of the seventh commandment, which is thou shalt not commit adultery. And there's added to it laws against incense, or incest, not incense. Incense was okay, incest was not. Against any lusts that they had, idolatries and various things that the Canaanites would do, their barbarous ways. God is giving them moral precepts here. Now, many of these things are reiterated in the New Testament. Let's look at some of them, and I'll quote you a few passages in the New Testament that reiterate some of these things. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt, where you dwelt, you shall not do. And according to the doings of the land of Canaan, where I am bringing to you, you shall not do, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances, walk in them. I am the Lord your God." So they came out with many different types of practices, beliefs. Think about some of the things maybe you practiced growing up and maybe not having the same moral background now that you get through the scriptures. Certain things you never thought were wrong. I know growing up, you know, it was just a standard thing that, you know, as a young man, you would try to have sex before marriage. I mean, I never thought of it as something that was, you know, horribly wrong. I figured that was just religious type of thing, but it's not horribly wrong. And so I never had that same background. There were practices that people, did that they didn't think anything of. And certainly that would have been true for the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. But he says, "I am the Lord your God. Therefore you shall keep my statutes, my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. I am the Lord." Now in this phrase, "which if a man does, he shall live by them," this is quoted in Romans and also in Galatians. And the idea here is, if you were to keep all of the laws, if it were possible for you to keep every one of these statutes and judgments, that you would have life by them. The idea is of eternal life. Now, naturally, they came to understand none of them could. The law was so odious to our flesh. You know, it's perfect, it's holy, it's good. The law is good. The law of God, in fact, you can't argue against anything the Lord has to say. All of his laws and his precepts are good. He foresees what happens in evil, and he guides us the right path. But none of us, in our own strength, have the capacity to live by all these things. Now people say, "Well, I keep the Ten Commandments." Well, you know, the Tenth Commandment itself basically, you know, would prove you a liar. Because that basically says you shouldn't even want to commit the first nine or break the first nine. You don't even desire, don't even covet your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's things or anything of your neighbor. Don't even desire it. Well, none of us qualify there. Because our heart is that of greed, and there are lusts, and there are things there. And yes, we curb them, but the same token is, it's there, it's working. But the idea here is that the Lord gave them for life. Eventually, this would be the tutor to lead them to life. And that's how it works. "None of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to him to uncover his nakedness," which is a euphemism for have sexual relationships with. When you see that term, uncover his nakedness, that's even akin to marry the person and have sexual relationships, or just have sexual relationships with them. "The nakedness of your father or the nakedness of your mother you shall not uncover." In other words, you don't have sexual relationships with your father or your mother, for she is your mother. You'll not uncover her nakedness. Verse 8, the nakedness of your father's wife you shall not uncover. It's your father's nakedness. That would be your stepmother, perhaps. The nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother, whether born at home or elsewhere, their nakedness you shall not cover. So sexual relationships with your sister are commanded against. And the nakedness of your son's daughter, which would be your granddaughter, or your daughter's daughter, their nakedness you shall not uncover, for theirs is your own nakedness. Is your own nakedness. The nakedness of your father's wife, father's wife's daughter, which would be your sister-in-law, begotten of your father, she's your sister, actually technically sister-in-law, you shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister, since she is near of kin to your father. That would be your aunt, nor shall you uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, for she is near of kin to your mother. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother. You shall not uncover you shall not approach her wife or his wife. She is your aunt. So you have the aunts, you have the uncles, you have the sisters, sister-in-laws, granddaughters, stepmothers, father, mother. These are incestuous relationships that are forbidden. Verse 15, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife. You shall not uncover her nakedness. Nor shall you, or you shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. Now this is, in this particular thing, if your brother, according to the Mosaic law later that's given, if your brother's wife dies and does not leave any, I'm sorry, if your brother dies and his wife has no children, there's no way that the name of inheritance can go now through that family. You're commanded as a brother to take her in as a wife if you're not married. And to then raise up a child after your brother's name. The first child would be your brother's. And that was a statute in order to keep and perpetuate the name in the family and the inheritance of the family. But this is obviously assuming that it's not right to take your brother's wife while your brother is still alive. And in fact, this was the one thing that led John the Baptist to preach against Herod. Because Herod had taken Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, to be his own wife while his brother Philip was alive. And that was certainly true of Rome. Rome was not exactly the most pure nation. They had much debauchery and licentiousness again around. So it was something common to them, but John the Baptist there in the land of Israel spoke against it. He was eventually put into prison and beheaded as a result of that. You shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter. Nor shall you take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. In other words, you don't take a woman and her daughter. They are near of kin to her. It's wickedness. Nor shall you take a woman as a rival to her sister to uncover her nakedness while the other is alive. That would only present obvious problems if you married two girls that were related to each other. Now again, some might argue, well, is the Lord allowing the fact that it's potentially possible to marry more than one person? Isn't that polygamy? Yes. Was that God's plan ever? He allowed it. He certainly allowed it. In the case, you look at Abraham and even with David, he warned kings not to take many wives. Jesus later described to us that it was because of the hardness of heart that Moses permitted such. But that he showed from the very beginning it was commanded that a man shall leave his father and mother and, you know, cleave unto his wife and the two shall become one flesh. That was God's plan for marriage all along. But he's bringing his people along. And there are many practices that, you know, apparently are not the top priority until later on as they begin to uncover this. This is interesting because Jacob married Leah and Rachel. And that is now something that would have been forbidden. You shall also not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is in her customary impurity. Moreover, you shall not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her. So now, the first he describes is relationships with near of kin. Now he gets into idolatry and the amplification of the seventh commandment there. And he says, you shall not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her. Very simple, committing adultery. You shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Molech. Nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. This was a custom If you think of it this way, if much sexual practices and deviant sexual behavior abounded in a nation, what you would have is many unwanted births. It's true in our nation today. You have a lot of deviant sexual behavior. You have a lot of unwanted births. Well, you've got to do something with all these unwanted births. And unfortunately, then, they had a customary practice of offering these little babies up to Molech. It was kind of a quick, easy way, easy solution. And plus, they felt they were appeasing this god, known as the god of pleasure. I think the type and the parallel is so amazing that today we don't put our little babies on a red-hot idol and sizzle them in the fire as they did then, or put them in a jar and, you know, put them in the wall, offering it up to the god of the house that, you know, you might have a prosperous house. You're offering your baby up as a sacrifice for your own pleasure. But unfortunately, though, in our sophistication, we found other means to deal with unwanted babies. Abortion has become a scourge in this country. 1.5 million babies each year are killed in the womb. And I think it's a horrible thing, but it's really a testimony. You've got exactly what's happening or happened then, offering their babies up to Molech, which the euphemism there is passing through the fire and profaning the name of the Lord. You have the same thing happening today, only in a different way. Because of the god of pleasure, unwanted pregnancies, then you have to do something with these unwanted pregnancies. And it's a sad, sad thing. Now, just in describing some of these aspects from the New Testament before we go on to the next verse, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 reiterates this whole picture. If you want to turn there for a moment. 1 says in verse 3, "This is the will of God, your sanctification, that you should abstain from sexual immorality. That each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in passion of lust," which would be the opposite of love, caring the best for someone, wanting the best for someone. The opposite of that is lust, taking for yourself, like the Gentiles who don't know God, and that no one should take advantage of and defraud his brother in this matter. You know, when you have sexual relationships outside of marriage, you're defrauding the other person. "Because the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also forewarned you and testified. For God did not call us to uncleanness, but in holiness. Therefore, he who rejects this does not reject man, but God, who has also given us of his Holy Spirit." And then he goes on to contrast that with brotherly love. But it was something that was forbidden. Peter says, "You spent enough time in the past doing what the pagans chose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousings, and detestable idolatry." So that was a part of your life in the past. And Paul says in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, "We should put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to our earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, evil desires, lust, and greed, which is idolatry." These were, you know, national laws, not just national laws for Israel, because actually, fascinatingly enough, not only are they reiterated in the New Testament, but the very reason God used Israel to judge the Canaanite people was because of these practices that went on. God saw these immoral acts and judgment came to the Canaanites as a result. And Sodom and Gomorrah were judged because of this, the debauchery and the sexual immorality and the going after strange flesh. And the same thing is going to happen to America. Judgment will come. Judgment really already is coming. America is not near the nation she was. She's a shell in comparison of what she once was. And I think a lot of it is because of the moral degradation of our society. The things that we have tolerated, the things that we have let go on. Well, adultery, 1 Corinthians 6:9 is a passage you can write down. "Know ye not that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Be not deceived. Neither fornicators, idolaters, adulterers, nor effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with mankind," which would be homosexuals, "will inherit the kingdom of heaven." Galatians 5:19 reiterates the same thing. And I think there's a very interesting picture. If you struggle in the area of lust, realize that that is common to all of us. I mean, we're all going to struggle in that area. What do you do with your lust? is the important thing. If you satisfy yourself with self-sex, or if you go after sexual immoral acts, what you're doing is you're only feeding the monster. The only way to deal with it is to starve it out. I challenged the men on the men's retreat when we were there. I got a lot of good feedback from that. Men struggling with the M word, struggling with the self-sex and pleasing themselves. I challenged them. I said, stop it for 30 days. Put it away for 30 days. Fight like anything you can to just not indulge yourself. And at the end of 30 days, see that it does not have any power over you. And you'll watch. You'll be amazed. I'm still getting feedback from guys honestly saying, hey, you know what? I really thank you for challenging me that. I've never heard anyone from a pulpit ever say anything about that. But I'm glad you said it, because it was something that I was secretly struggling with. And God just totally delivered me. It's amazing how different my life is, how changed I am. I believe it's something that really wipes you out, guys, when you don't keep that under control. You must keep your body under control. Proverbs chapter 6 gives a lot of interesting insight into lust and idolatry and adultery. I normally turn to 5, 7, and 9 because I use the 5, 7, and 9 shops, petite women, to remind me of the passages there about lust. It kind of helps. And if you're a guy and you want to know, gee, where do I go in the Bible to be encouraged and struggle in this area? Well, you'll remember now. It's Proverbs 5, 7, and 9. But I'll leave that up for your own to look into. Let's go to the next verse. Verse 22. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. There is a growing movement in this country to accept homosexuality as a normal lifestyle, a choice. Or even that which people are saying, that I was born this way, God made me this way, so therefore there is nothing morally wrong with homosexuality. This not only is here, but it is also reiterated all the way through scriptures. Romans chapter 1, verse 26 and 27 leaves no doubt as to what he's referring to, of God giving them up to vile affections for their women, exchanging the natural use for that which is against nature, and men likewise leaving the natural use of the woman, burning in lust one toward another, men with men working which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves the recompense of their error. You can't really dance around those very plain passages of Scripture and come to some other conclusion that, well, maybe God didn't mean what he said. Or maybe he meant something else. There are homosexual theologians that will actually debate this point and argue and very artfully come up with a way that explains away these passages that they don't apply to homosexuals today. I think I have a real difficult time with that. Now, I feel burden for anyone in that lifestyle. It is a miserable lifestyle. They go by the name gay. Unfortunately, they're not. They'll claim to be. But I mean, that lifestyle is wrought with so much pain because of the emotional breakup. I mean, the average homosexual does not stay in a monogamous relationship. They don't stay in the same relationship for very long. You might know some exceptions, people that have been together for 15, 20 years. I mean, that's very possible. But on average, it's a constant flux of relationship to relationship. Emotional damage, right on through. There's not a stability. God saw this. God didn't design that. He designed that a man and a woman would come together and become one flesh and be committed for life. That is God's design. If you have passions and lusts and desires that are deviated from that, then I think what you need to do is you need to take it before the Lord. Realize if you have affections that go in that direction, that does not make you a homosexual. You obviously have to curb those lusts like anyone else and let the Lord do a work in your heart. You don't become a homosexual until you commit your first homosexual act. And there are a lot of young people, I think, getting duped by the homosexual community to try to come out and be honest with what they feel. Well, many of these young kids raised in homes, they are confused. They don't know. They're not having... And they're not developing perhaps at the same time that somebody else is. And so naturally they think, I'm different. And then the homosexual community comes along and you're going to see a lot more of it in the schools, in the public schools, authorizing it. Not only authorizing it, but encouraging it. It's a sad thing, because I think there's going to be a whole generation of young men and women duped because of the struggles they've had in their life or whatever. Now they've come to a place where they're going to be, feeling that, well, I'm not developing like somebody else, so I must be different. And then they'll find themselves encouraged in those acts that will eventually lead them down a lifestyle that will be a very difficult thing to change. It is a very difficult thing. There are many people, actually, that have come out of that lifestyle and gone on to lead very normal lives. The Lord has blessed them as they've repented of that sin, just like He would bless anyone that's committing adultery. If you repent, He will bless you, and He will, you know, forgive you of your sin and restore you of your sin. And I would not treat it any differently than adultery. It's a choice. Nor shall you mate with any beast to defile yourself with it. Nor shall any woman stand before a beast to mate with it. It is a perversion, bestiality. Do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. Notice, the very reason He was casting them out, these were the sins. For the land is defiled, therefore I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. Very interesting, picturesque thing, you know, the land vomiting out the people. I can't help but think of the susceptibility in the homosexual community to AIDS because of the abuse of the body in an unnatural way. It subjects itself to damage, tearing of the tissue, which then will produce the blood, which makes you susceptible. God didn't design those bodies to function that way. And so you find the very punishment for the sin is found within the sin itself, as is often the case. The very thing that we cherish and hold on to as sin is the very thing that eats at us. Now, that does not mean that AIDS is a judgment of God upon the homosexual community. I find that when you deviate from God's laws, the natural punishment is there already in place. Just as if there, you know, the natural laws of driving into a tree at 60 miles an hour, you're not going to look the same after doing that. You will be changed. You know, it will have an effect on you. The natural laws of gravity and inertia are going to have an effect on you. And that's just the way it is. The same thing, too, when you violate God's moral laws, it will have an effect on you. It will change you. Therefore, He says, you shall keep my statutes, my judgments, not commit any of these abominations, either any of your own nation or any stranger who sojourns among you. For all these abominations the men of the land have done who were before you, and thus the land is defiled, lest the land vomit you also out when you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that were before you. God says, hey, if you allow these things to be a part of you, you'll also be vomited out. For whoever commits any of these abominations, the persons who commit them shall be cut off from among their people. Therefore you shall keep my ordinance, so that you do not commit any of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that you do not defile yourselves by them. I am the Lord your God.